ask you a question. Why are you here? Now, this is a question that we often hear every year at the Feast of Tabernacles. Usually in the beginning of the feast, somebody will ask that question. And that question is asked in the hopes that you will examine the heart and motivation for why you took time off of work, school, other activities in order to go and keep the Feast of Tabernacles. It's a question that's asked that we would then consider whether we're there for the right reasons, for the right purpose, with the right priorities. And it's a question that's asked in the hopes that we might return home with a renewed zeal, a renewed commitment to strengthen our relationship with our Heavenly Father, with our Jesus Christ, and certainly with one another. So let's ask the question today. Why are you here in Mansfield? Some are like, you're like, we're visiting because we're going to camp. That's why we're here. You know, our formal mission statement of the United Church of God is to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ and the kingdom of God into all the world, to make disciples in all nations, and to care for those disciples. And when you think about it, you know, we have a slogan, we have a motto on our little seal here in front of the lectern that says, you know, preach the gospel, prepare a people. It's kind of a summation of that mission statement. And when you think about it, at the local level, the one aspect we probably have the most influence, the most direct impact on, is the second half. Preparing a people, more so than preaching the gospel. You know, every week we're together. Through the week we may get together, but the one thing we have a direct opportunity to bring about is preparing a people. But prepare them for what? What are we preparing a people for? Let's follow this through here for a moment. You know, it's through God's church that he's preparing future rulers. We know the verse that talks about kings and priests. Some translations call it a kingdom of priests. So it depends on how you want to read that translation. You can see that in Revelation 5. You can see that also in 1 Peter 2:9. He's preparing us to be a kingdom of priests, or a kings and priests. And so knowing then what we're being prepared for, what are we doing to prepare ourselves for that? I'll give you a hint. It involves much more than just coming to services every week, listening to a couple messages, thinking we've gained a little more knowledge, and then we go home. It's more than that. You know, it's like reading a book. You know, I could read a book on how to do something and think I've obtained the knowledge to do it, but it's not until I actually go try it that I really begin to know if I really learned anything. Because it's through the application of what I've learned that you really begin to know, truly understand what you read. If we go to Mark chapter 10, Jesus explained the type of rulers that he wants, that his Father wants in his kingdom. The type of rulers we need to be if we're going to rule. This is a familiar passage. James and John came before him asking to sit on his right hand and on his left, and notice Jesus' response. Mark chapter 10, we'll begin in verse 35. Excuse me. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him, saying, "Teach us whatever we ask." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" They said to him, "Grant us that we may sit one on your right hand and the other on your left in your glory." But Jesus said to him, "You do not know what you..." Let's drop down to verse 42. Jesus called them to himself and he said, "You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them, yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you shall be, and whoever of you desires to be first shall be of all." The type of leader that Jesus Christ is described as seeking for his kingdom are those that are willing to serve. Not seeking to lord over people, but coming with an attitude of service. So our preparation, our act of preparing a people has to involve serving. Because it's in the act of serving that we develop the proper skill set, the proper attitude, the proper character that accompanies any knowledge or skills that we may have. Now, the vision statement of the church, I'd like to read that, is a church led by God's Holy Spirit, joined and knit together by what every member supplies, with all doing their share and growing in love to fulfill God's great purpose for humanity to bring many sons to glory. Did you notice those two statements? What every member supplies, ask yourself, what have I been supplying, right, to the church? What have I been supplying, contributing, giving? And I'm not talking money. Right? We're talking about serving today. What have I been supplying? In the other statement, it says, all doing their share. What share of the load have I been carrying when I think about my congregation and opportunities to serve and to contribute? You know, another way to look at this, a way to kind of examine ourselves in this regard is, if everybody served, just think about yourself and what you contribute in serving or helping out. If everyone served the needs of the congregation in the same manner and with the same amount of time and energy and effort that I do, what would that look like? So if you don't do anything, then the summation of everybody doing nothing would be nothing got done. So that would be an extreme, right? That would be an extreme. In the sermon today, I'd like us to see and maybe consider why we're here. And it's more than just being church attendees. We're here to be co-laborers. Co-laborers. Helping to care for those disciples and to, you know, help to prepare a people. I've titled the sermon, Every Member Doing Their Share. Every member doing their share. I want to start with a humorous illustration. This is something that you may have already heard. I remember it from years ago. Simplest but maybe most meaningful stories to help us understand inherent problems that come about when things are not organized or clearly defined. Now, every source that I found says that this is anonymous. And I jokingly say, I'd like to know who anonymous is, because they're getting a lot of royalties on a lot of stuff. Because there's a lot of stuff out there that's written by anonymous. So whoever that person is, they're making a killing. It's titled, Whose Job Is It Anyway? And it's the story of four people named Everybody, Somebody, Anybody, and Nobody. I'm going to read it slow. You probably still are going to get lost, because unless you've got it in front of you, you get lost in this. So you can go home and search for it on the internet, and you'll find it pretty easily. There was an important job to be done, and everybody was sure that somebody would do it. Anybody could have done it, but nobody did it. Somebody got angry about that because it was everybody's job. Everybody thought anybody could do it, but nobody realized that everybody wouldn't do it. That was the first sentence. It ended up that everybody blamed somebody when nobody did what anybody could have. It's a very simple story, humorous and somewhat confusing, but it does illustrate a point that if there's no organization and people don't know what to do or are instructed what to do or given opportunities to serve, nothing gets done and everything just falls apart. The summation of the story is that no one takes responsibility, so nothing gets accomplished. Matthew 25, let's look at a familiar parable of the talents in Matthew 25. In Matthew chapter 25, verse 14. Now, I'm going to go through this a bit quickly. Verse 14, Matthew 25. For the kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling to a far country who called his own servants and delivered his goods to them, and to one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, to each according to his own ability, and immediately he went on a journey. Now we know the story, so let me just paraphrase it. We know that it says here that he who had received 5 went, and they produced 5 more. And the one that had 2, they went, and they produced 2 more. Right? So they both doubled what they had. And so in verse 20, he who had received 5 talents came, brought 5 other talents, saying, Lord, you delivered to me 5. I've gained 5 more talents. The Lord said to him, verse 21, well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful over a few things. I'll make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. He also who had received 2 talents came and said, Lord, you delivered to me 2 talents. Look, I have gained 2 more talents besides them. And His Lord said to him, same commendation, right? Same response. You've been faithful over a few things. I'll make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. And the one who had received one talent, verse 24, said, Lord, I knew you to be. Now, a better translation is, I perceived you to be a hard man, reaping where you've sown and gathering where you've not scattered seed. And I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. I did nothing with it. I didn't do anything. It's basically his response. Look, here you have back what is yours. And his Lord answered and said to him, you wicked and lazy servant, if it is that you perceive that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed, should you ought to have deposited my money to the bankers, and at my coming I would have received back my own with interest. I mean, if you're going to do nothing with it, at least do something where it can gain interest and return it back to me with interest. He says, therefore, take the talent from him, give it to him who has 10, and for everyone who has more will be given, but to him will... Let me just slow down. Verse 29, for to everyone who has more will be given, and he will have abundance, but from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, the Expositor's Bible Commentary notes that the talents are distributed according to the master's evaluation of their capacities, right? They were not given more than they could handle. We always think of that in the context of trials. We say, oh, well, God doesn't give us a trial more than we can handle. It says even with talents, he gives you what you're capable to handle. He doesn't put on different people different things they're not capable of doing. He gave each according to what the master felt they were capable of. In a book titled The Message of Matthew, it says both the five-talent man and the two-talent man made full responsible use of what they'd be given. They both doubled what they had. Didn't matter how much they had. They took it and they doubled it. They both, you know, percentage-wise, had the same increase, 100%. And they both got the same response in the end, right? Enter into the joy of your Lord. So what we learn is it's not the quantity. It's not what your skills are versus somebody else's skills, what your talents may be versus somebody other, but it's what you do with them, whatever God has given to you to do. What we learn from this is only those that don't try are condemned. Only the one that didn't try is the one that was condemned. And so the lesson for us is to put to good use that which we're, you know, what God has entrusted in us. You know, he has given to each and every one of us different gifts and talents and skills and abilities. We witness that just even watching special music. You know, I don't play any musical instruments. It's not something I'm gifted at. I've tried over the years, and I probably don't devote the time or the discipline to it. I have other things that occupy my time. But I respect that other people have that skill and that gift. And so they're able to give and share of that in the manner that they've been gifted. But God does expect us to use whatever gifts he has given to us and for the benefit of all of us. You know, we don't have a gift to just sit and hoard it. He wants us to, again, prepare a people and that we would find ways to, you know, serve one another. Let's continue in Matthew 25. Notice verse 31. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels with him, he will sit on the throne of his glory and all the nations shall be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. He will set the sheep on his right hand, the goats on the left, and the king will come to those on his right hand. Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Now notice what happens next. I was hungry, you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. And the righteous will answer, what are you talking about? What do you mean? Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty or give you drink? When did we see you a stranger, take you in, naked and clothe you? When did you see you sick or in prison and come to you? It wasn't something they thought about. That's just who they were. That's just how they lived. They didn't pay special attention to, you know, I'm checking off this, you know, I woke up, I joke that sometimes I say, it's like you wake up in the morning and say, if I could just find a hungry, naked, thirsty prisoner and visit him, I could just check all boxes off in one day. That's not what they were doing. They just saw needs and they filled them. It wasn't a part of them, like, oh, I need to make sure I do this today. And so they were a bit shocked when he pointed out that they did these things. Verse 40, the king will answer and say to them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. And so as we see opportunities to serve one another, we just do it. Because it's the right thing to do, not because we're trying to check off a box, right? It's like, it's just, there's a need, and I can help in this regard, and so I'm going to do that. And likewise, if we continue, he will also say to those, verse 41 on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, in the everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. And he states the exact opposite, right? I was hungry, you gave me no food. I was thirsty, you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, you did not take me in. Naked, you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, you did not visit me. And they will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you? And they go down the list, hungry or thirsty, a stranger, naked, sick, or in prison, and did not minister. That word is serve to you. And he will answer them, saying, assuredly I will say to you, and as much as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. The lesson is to make it part of our character to just see needs and jump in. Don't need to be told. Don't need, you know, it's, I don't have a checklist. I pull it out. Still looking for the stranger today because I've got the other ones checked off. It's just, it's a heart that just sees needs and fills them. Finds opportunities to serve and are willing to get involved and serve in whatever manner we can. In 1 Peter chapter 4, again, God expects us to serve each other with whatever gifts, skills, talents he's given us. 1 Peter chapter 4. First Peter chapter 4, verse 10. For if anyone speaks, let him... That's 11. As each one has received a gift, minister it to one another. That word for minister there is diakonos. Diakonos, it means to serve. It's used throughout the New Testament. The words minister and serve are often used interchangeably. It says then to, as each one's received a gift, minister it, serve one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. And then he goes on to say, if anyone speaks, let him speak as oracles of God. If anyone ministers, serves, let him do it as with the ability which God supplies you, that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belong the glory and the dominion forever and ever. So whatever those gifts are that God has entrusted to you, you'll find ways to use them to serve one another, and again, to help in that process of preparing a people. Now, we're going to look at a couple aspects of serving. I'm going to look at two sides of the issue. I want to go to Nehemiah chapter 2 first. Nehemiah, you know, during the time of Nehemiah, Jerusalem had been destroyed by King Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian army. The people were led into captivity, and those that had returned after 70 years found it difficult to rebuild. I can go over to Nehemiah chapter 2. And so upon learning of this situation, this distress of his people, Nehemiah gets permission from King Artaxerxes to go and help, to see what he can do. And we're just going to jump into the story in Nehemiah chapter 2. In verse 11, we'll see that despite obstacles, oppositions, and things that are in front of him, he is going to motivate the people to move forward and get the project done. Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 11. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. And then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well and the refuse gate and viewed the walls of Jerusalem which were broken down and its gates which were burned with fire. And then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal under me to pass. And so I went up in the night by the valley and I viewed the wall. And then I turned back and I entered by the valley gate and so returned. Verse 16. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. And so Nehemiah arrives on the scene. He tours and inspects the conditions and begins to assess the project in front of him and what needed to be done. Notice then in verse 17, "Then I said to them, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words they had spoken to me. And so they said, yeah, Nehemiah, you get right on that, buddy. Go ahead and build that wall. Yay, Nehemiah. No, that is not at all what they said. Notice at the end of verse 18, let us rise up and build. And they set their minds to this good work. You know, the people said, let us all together join in, rise and build this wall. You know, Nehemiah was the spark plug, if you will. He had the vision, and he was able to inspire the people and motivate them. And then we won't read through it, but if you read through chapter 3, one of the things you notice is that some people did building. Some said did repairs. Some worked on gates and hinges and did ironwork. Perfumers were involved. Goldsmiths were involved. Let's just look at some of these. Verse 1 of chapter 3 speaks of Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with the other priests and built. So they built the sheep gate. That word for built is used in the next few verses. Verse 3, the sons of Hezaniah built the fish gate. They laid its beams. They hung its doors with its bolts and its bars. So they had skills in doing that type of work. If we go to verse 4, it speaks to, towards the end of it, Meshesabel made repairs. Next to them, Zadok, the son of Bana, made repairs. So different people had different skills. Some were building from scratch. Some were making repairs. Some were hanging doors, doing ironwork. Down in verse 8, it speaks of one of the goldsmiths made repairs. Next to him, one of the perfumers made repairs. And so we see that all these different people with all their different skills were all involved in this process of rebuilding. Everybody was contributing according to the skills and the abilities that they had. Everybody was doing something different, but it was all a contribution. If we go over to Nehemiah 6:15, we can see as a result of this, and so the wall was finished on the 25th day of Elul in 52 days. Something they couldn't do in 150 years got done in 52 days when everybody put it in their heart to join in and let's do this. And, you know, everybody's contribution was different. I'm sure some broke more sweat than others, but it didn't matter. Everybody doing their part, and it all came together in 52 days. You know, God wants us to serve as part of our calling. As I said, we're called to become a kingdom of priests, you know, serving in God's kingdom, and we need to learn to serve. Now, we could read all the books in the world on serving and leadership and all those kind of things, but until you actually try to put it to practice, as I said, you really don't know if you learned anything. You know, it is through that act of serving that we learn how to get things done, how to plan, how to organize, how to assign different people's different responsibilities, how to execute tasks, how to go to, or when to go to plan B when something doesn't work. You don't learn that in the book. You know, the book will tell you to have a plan B, but it's that, when do you go to that? When do you bail on what you're trying to do and go to plan B because you finally realize this is not going to work? It's going through that and having responsibilities that we learn that. We learn to adapt, as I said, when things don't go as planned. We also learn patience with those over us. You got a boss you don't care for so much, and you got to learn to be patient. You learn to be patient with those on either side of you, your co-laborers, because you feel like you're carrying the lion's share of the weight here, right? And they're not helping out. Well, you learn patience in that. And you also learn patience with those that are maybe, quote, under us. Because, you know, I told you twice, you're still not doing it the way I want it, and you got to learn to be patient. You know, I, if I'm honest with myself, one of my big problems is I tend to want to do everything myself. And if I can be really bare my soul here, part of that, if I'm really honest with myself, is a vanity issue. Because nobody's going to do it exactly the way I want it done. I mean, can we be honest here? And so I'd rather just do it myself so it's the way I want it, right? But you can't, that only takes you so far because you can't do everything, right? And so individuals like me who are very A-type, OCD, those of you who know me know that, right? I'd rather just do it myself rather than trying to go, because you know what my logic is? I'm just going to have to go back later and fix it all, blah, 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 blah. So I have to learn to coach people and guide them, because you know what often happens in people like that? The part we're not assessing is maybe my instructions weren't right. Maybe I wasn't really clear. See, we never do that. No, I was totally clear. They just didn't do it. Right? You see, so even that, when you have people that are under you taking direction, there's a lesson you have to learn in that. So it's not till you're put in those circumstances that God begins to know, can you honestly serve? Can you be a leader that can work with people? Because that's when you're tested on that, and you begin to realize, okay, I need to get better over here. I can't just do everything myself. So let me share some examples of what I mean, why it's in the act of serving that we really begin to know if we've learned anything. These are some real-world examples. One I believe I've shared with you. A congregation my wife and I grew up in had a tile floor, just like we see up in this area, well, 1 foot tiles, the whole floor was that way. And we had, our pastor had two different crews. You had your January, March, May crew, so they alternated months. And we had, there was a lot of people in the congregation then, so you had your hall setup crew that came in on January, a different one was February, then they just alternated months. Okay. Well, the two men leading the crews disagreed on how the chairs were supposed to be set. Right? Yeah, it's funny, sad, not funny, ha-ha. Because the first Sabbath of the month, the one guy would come in and his crew would set up all the chairs, and he used the tiles as your lineup, right? And they lined up all the chairs, the rows were perfect. Right? Guess what happened? The first Sabbath of the next month, that guy and his crew came in and they moved them, not exaggerating, one tile. They literally moved everything one tile. The rows were still perfect. At the end result, this went on for months. We would come to church early just to watch the entertainment. And the two, they fought with each other over what is the center line of the hall. And God is about not, God doesn't believe in chaos. It's about order. And, so it became, I'm more righteous because it's this way. It was funny, sad, not funny, ha-ha. They had it up here, but it's when you're doing it that it comes out to God, whether or not you're capable of leading and serving. Because it's when they had to do it that, at the end of the day, it took the pastor at the time stepping in, passing an edict. He had to pass a rule because they couldn't, between the two of them, neither would back down and say, okay, you know what, we'll just do it your way. Like, just to end all of this. No, they both dug their heels in. So that's an example where they were both fully capable of setting up chairs. That wasn't the issue. They had the knowledge, the skills, the capabilities, but the character part of being a leader and serving, that's the part you don't learn until you're doing it. So you see why we need to be in opportunities to serve and do things together. So that's one. Another one was when we were in New England and we came to church early, and our family usually showed up at the morning congregation early to help with setup. Services started at 10:30, I believe. We usually got there about 9:30, and helped another family with setup. And for a few weeks after we got there, came in one Sabbath, and one of the individuals, and I'm not exaggerating, was screaming at the top of his lungs at somebody else for getting to church 5 minutes late. He was part of the setup crew. And instead of being there at 9:30, he got there at 9:35. Services are at 10:30, right? Now, let me add to this. The guy who was 5 minutes late drives 2 hours and 10 minutes to get to church. And he got stuck in traffic. So I pulled the guy aside. I said, what are you doing? When I said 9:30, I mean 9:30. I'm like, oh, man. So, I was like, well, guess what you're not going to do anymore? You're not going to be in charge anymore. Because that's not how, I mean, there's mercy and compassion. And I said, you know, I've been to that man's house. It's over 2 hours to get there, over the mountain, right? Bad weather and all. So did he have the knowledge on how to organize a crew? And yeah, we should be here at 9:30. I'm as the team leader, whatever, let's all be here at 9:30. We all agreed to 9:30. But do you snap because it's 9:35? Well, how does that come out of a person unless they're put in that circumstance? So these are examples why we should put ourselves in circumstances to serve, to be served, to take on leadership roles when we're asked, because we learn those challenges that go with it. So those are just two I thought I would share with you that I've witnessed in my life that makes it clear to me why we can think we know how to serve. That's just knowledge. That's head stuff. But it's when we're there and now we're confronted with whatever it may be, you know, and then what do you do about it and how do you handle that? And that's where God knows, you know, maybe you need a little bit more time in this whole serving thing because you're not learning the patience part of, you know, managing people or the mercy part of it. Oh, sorry to hear that my accident held you up or whatever it may be. Didn't even take time to ask those questions, just tore into the person. So it's important that we learn and we actively put into practice what we know, or as these examples show, what we think we know, right? They thought they knew how to lead, but in reality, they didn't. You know, when Nehemiah told the people about the hand of God and the king's favor and allowing him to go there, you know, they didn't, as I like to say, they didn't pull out lawn chairs and pop up umbrellas and sip on lemonade and say, go, Nehemiah, you know. They said, let's all go in together and build. And that's the attitude we should all have, whether it's here locally, you know, every year at the feast. I know when in the years I was a festival coordinator, it's, some people just, oh no, the feast is my vacation. Well, guess whose vacation it isn't? The ministry doesn't get a vacation. They're actually assigned jobs to do, right? And they're usually the ones trying to get people to help in these roles. So it shouldn't just simply be a vacation. I get it. You know, I understand that sometimes we have to use our vacation time to go to the feast, but there's got to be something we can do there to serve, right? There's got to be something. But again, their response here in Nehemiah was, let us all join in and rebuild. You know, it's interesting, but God often provides means and resources, but he still expects us to do something. When he put Adam and Eve in the garden, what did he tell them? Hey, just hang out here and enjoy this Garden of Eden. Remember what he said to them? He placed them in the garden to what? To tend it and to keep it. Right? They had work to do. It wasn't just to enjoy it. They were told, here, this is a beautiful Garden of Eden, but I put you here to tend it and to keep it. And the same was true with Noah. There's a flood coming. Just hang out here. Time's right. I'll send a boat. Nope. Flood's coming. You better get to work. And so resources were there. Noah had to, again, start going to work. When it comes to serving, sometimes people suffer from what I call the terrible twos. It's T-O-O, not T-W-O, terrible twos. We find ourselves being too busy, too tired, too old, too young. We're too this, we're too that. And as a result, we don't even try. And we simply make excuses. Remember the parable of talents. It's only the ones that don't try that were condemned. That's the key. Find something. Find some way to contribute. Now, I want to go to the flip side of the scenario where there's people that don't serve. Because, you know, as I've talked to different people here, you know, by and large, this is a congregation that's willing to jump in and serve. But there's a flip side of those that when it comes to serving, because the one side is those that don't serve, and so nothing gets done. And there's the opposite extreme where a few people are pulling all the weight, and they just burn out. They just flat burn out. I'll be honest with you. A few weeks ago when we made a change in the schedule, you had the DVD. I was scheduled to be here to speak. That day was our anniversary, and my wife and I were planning, so we go to church, and we could leave, we'll go someplace. And finally, I think it was like Wednesday, I said, I'm just burned out. I'm burned out. We'll take the Sabbath. We'll go. So we went to New River Gorge. We sat on the mountain. We tuned in on the telephone, listened to you guys, and then went over to the webcast in Columbus and just sat on the mountain. I burned out. And I finally had to admit myself, I'm just burning out. And that's true in any capacity when a few people are carrying most of the weight. Let's go to Exodus 18. Let's look at that scenario in Scripture, because after the Israelites had left Egypt, Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, comes to Moses, brings his wife and his sons to come and visit. Moses is in the wilderness. He's encamped at Mount Sinai. Jethro rejoiced, it says, as he heard all the Lord had done for them. And notice in Exodus 18, verse 13. And so it was on the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood before Moses from morning until evening. And so when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit, and all the people stand before you from morning until evening?" Now, I could tell you, just if I interject my thoughts and the type of personality I tend to be, like I just shared about the guy who says, "Well, I want it done my way, so I'll just do it myself." I could see Moses going, "Well, there's a certain way to do it, and yes, I know how to do it, so I'm going to do it, and I'm going to get it done." Right? I don't know if that's exactly what was going on here. I read it through the lens of my own issues, right? So I'll just share it that way. And Moses said, verse 15, to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a difficulty, they come to me, and I judge between one another, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws." And so Moses is like, look, it's my job. They got issues between them. They come to me. I resolve them, and that's just how it is. And so Jethro then is going to give some counsel to Moses in this regard, telling him basically, Moses, you can't do this. You cannot continue at this pace. You're going to burn out. I'll use a modern terminology. You're going to burn out. If you keep doing this, Jethro's basically saying, you can't keep it. You can't keep going at this pace. And there's a lot of reasons why, but notice then what he goes on to say beginning in verse 17. So Moses' father-in-law said to him, "The thing that you do is not good. Both you and these people who are with you will surely wear yourselves out." Everybody's going to get burned out. Think about it from both perspectives. Because what did he say here? Right? You and these people will wear yourselves out. Imagine having a waiting line for Moses. Maybe you're, take a number, 400. Well, they ended up at 388 today. Come back tomorrow. You get back, there's a new line, pull number, you're 265. I mean, imagine day after day waiting on Moses, because Moses is the only one. So not only is Moses going to burn out, the people are going to burn out and get weary waiting, because it all has to funnel through Moses. It's called a leadership funnel. There's problems in businesses that deal with the same thing. One guy thinks he's got to make all the decisions, so no decisions get made because he's too busy. But nobody else can make the decision. It has to go through that person. It becomes a leadership bottleneck, right? Because the one guy won't hand that responsibility off. And so it's not just Moses that's going to burn out here. The people also are going to burn out. "For this thing is too much for you. You are not able to perform it by yourself. Listen now to my voice," verse 19. "I will give you counsel, and God will be with you. Stand before God for the people, so that you may bring the difficulties to God, and you shall teach them the statutes and the laws and show them the way in which they must walk and the work they must do." Verse 21, "Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And let them judge the people at all times. Then it will be that every great matter they shall bring to you, but every small matter they themselves shall judge. But it will be easier for you, for they will bear the burden with you." Carry the load. Carry the load is what he's telling Moses needs to be done here. Notice verse 23, "And if you do this thing and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all this people will also go to their place in peace." The place in peace is a reference back to Exodus 16:29, and reference to the Sabbath. Be able to enter into the Sabbath, restful, and at peace, not burned out. And so he gives Moses this advice. You know, Jethro's advice here, if you notice, was to instruct others. Don't just hand off the responsibility. Teach them, show them, instruct them, mentor them, so that they're going to be able to take on many of those things. You know, no one person can do it all, right? Jethro's assessment of Moses was, you are surely going to burn out, and the people as well. Moses thankfully heeded that advice and made some changes. You know, notice in 2 Timothy chapter 2, because even if one person could do all the work, it's not in their best interest, nor is it in the best interest of the church as a whole. 2 Timothy chapter 2. Again, even if one person was able to do it all, notice 2 Timothy 2, verse 2. And the things that you have heard from me among many witnesses, commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. There is a responsibility to pass things on and pass things down. Teach the next generation so that the church can continue. Right? If one person has to do it all, then what happens when the one person dies? Nobody knows how to do anything. Everybody's just staring at each other. Well, how do we do this? I don't know. He did it. What about this? Well, I don't know. He did it. What about that? Oh, well, he did that. What do we do? I don't know. Where do we start? I don't know. So even if one person could, it's not a smart thing to do. You need to teach and mentor and train another generation to come along. And so Jethro's advice to Moses, you know, delegate some of these matters. He wasn't suggesting Moses was weak or incapable. He simply said, you'll burn out. The people also will burn out. It's for everybody's benefit that you distribute the workload. So we need to train and mentor and develop another generation to take on responsibilities. It's a win-win when you think about it. Everybody wins in the end. A few people that have been carrying the load carry less of the load. More people are involved, and they learn how to do things. You know, good leaders are always asking themselves, what can we do to improve things? I'm going to go back to Nehemiah, and then I'm going to jump back over to Exodus again. But go back again to Nehemiah, chapter 4. We skipped over this earlier, but notice in Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 7, there's a plot that develops to destroy the progress that's been made. Now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs and Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, that they became very angry and all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem. So this plot is developing to stop the progress. Nehemiah could have just kept plowing ahead with his plan. Didn't have a plan B. And who knows how that would have ended. But he recognized, is there a better way we can do things, right? Can we do things differently? Can we change things? And if you drop down to verse 16, you notice that he makes some changes. And so it was from that time on that half my servants worked at construction, the other half held spears and shields and bows and wore armor, and leaders were behind all the house of Judah. You can keep reading. Some worked with the tools in one hand and a spear in the other. The point being that people in charge are always looking for ways to do things better, to adapt and change as necessary in order to get things done. If we go back to Exodus 18, Exodus chapter 18, because it's not good enough to just have a good idea. You know, Jethro gave Moses a really good idea, and if he'd have said, well, that's a really good idea, and that would have been the end of it, that's all it would have been, is just an idea. Moses, thankfully, as I said, took action. He accepted it. He went about, and as was instructed, he chose people, he delegated authority to them, and they got busy doing their job, just as Moses was doing his. Exodus 18, verse 24, so Moses heeded the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said, and Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of 50, and rulers of 10, and they went on to judge the people. So some additional bits of information we glean here out of this story here in Exodus is that the character of the people needed for a task is just as important, I might even say more important, than their skills. Because notice what it was said in verse 21 to choose able men, that word could be virtuous. Choose people that are able or virtuous, God-fearing, truthful, haters of covetousness. I can teach you skills a lot easier than I can teach you character. It's as simple as that. You could teach me skills a lot easier than you could teach me character. You want to choose people of character, you can teach them the skills. That's not the hard part. Skills can be taught, they can be honed, they can be, you know, developed over time. So that's one of the principles we see here, is to choose people of character. And how does that apply to us today, right? We want people who will show up on time to do their job, will follow through on their commitments. You know, as I talk to people and ask them to serve at different times, they'll say, you know, I don't expect you, if you're like here, if you're running the sound system, right? You don't want you locked in every week, like you can't visit somewhere. Just make sure it's covered. Simple as that. If somebody's our song leader, they're speaking and they can't be here 1 week, just make sure it's covered to get somebody to, you know, swap. So it's about having the character and the capacity to know to not just not show up, but to have somebody cover for you. The second thing we learn here is that different people are capable of different tasks. Right? We read, just as similar to the parable of the talents, appoint them over thousands, hundreds, fifties, tens. Set them up for success. Give them responsibilities that they can handle. Don't give them something they can't handle. Give them something they can handle, let them grow at that. Then you can expand as their skills develop and give them more things. But give people what they're capable of doing. One more principle to look at is, as we balance all of this out, we can't put our entire focus on serving others if we're not serving our families and our own households. There was a period of time in the church when men would neglect their families, neglect their responsibilities at home, because they were always serving at church. Right? Some of the most faithful men I can think of when I was growing up, who were just dedicated to always dropping everything to go serve others. You know, when you go visit at their house is falling apart because they never took time to just take care of themselves. And so all of what we do has to be balanced. We have to make sure that we're not neglecting those responsibilities as well. 1 Timothy 5 speaks to that. I just want to touch on that before we move on. I'm going to try to wrap this up here in the next 5 minutes or so. 1 Timothy chapter 5. Again, this is all about balance. It's all about balance, making sure that we're, again, those individuals that come to my mind from years ago, they, you know, I think in their minds, if I just put every single ounce of my energy into serving the church, God will take care of everything else. And yet God says, no, it starts at home, right? Because you got to make sure that you're doing your responsibility at home. And then you add to that service in other areas. 1 Timothy 5, verse 4. It speaks here of widows. It says, if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home and to repay their parents, for this is good and acceptable for God. The Amplified Bible says, you know, if a widow has children or grandchildren, see to it that these are first made to understand it's their duty to defray their natural obligation to those at home. You know, we've had occasions in the church, you know, the church has means to give assistance to widows in need, but we usually start out asking, what about your family? You know, if the family's just not going to do anything, we'll just dump them on the church, that's, the Bible says that's not what's expected. You know, it's up to the family to look after family. And so that's usually where it starts. Drop on down then to verse 8. Again, if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he's denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So there's several principles in the Bible that tell us that, you know, we have to do all of this in balance. Now, I'm not appealing to everybody to drop everything you're doing and start serving at church. I got a 87% finished basement at home. I just keep plugging away at, right? So we can't just neglect things that we have at home, right? That's not appropriate either. It's all about balance. But it's finding time that we can serve. So where does this all take us? Why did I decide to speak on this topic? Well, some of it was probably because I burned out, to be quite frank, just no particular reason. But just realizing that sometimes you just got to stop and get away and reflect. But as I reflected upon it, it became obvious to me that as we're coming out of this past year, which has been unlike any other year that we've ever experienced, you know, some interesting things have happened. This last year has been a real disruption, if I can use that term. It's really just disrupted everything. Now, there's a whole argument about disruption in organizations can actually be a good thing, right? It makes you kind of go back and revisit, why do we do what we do and how are we doing it and is there a better way? So disrupting an organization, its routines, isn't always bad. So sometimes these disruptions do exactly that. We examine ourselves. Why are we doing what we're doing? But we need to get back to planning and organizing events and activities, right? We got to get back to, you know, the Wilson's Picnic is going to be a great opportunity to just get back to being together and doing things. We were just talking before services about planning potlucks again. Let's get back to having potlucks and doing those kind of things. So we need to get back to doing those kind of things. But we don't just want to go necessarily back to the same old people doing the same old things and maybe burning out. Now's a great opportunity to say, can we get more people involved? Are there other people that want to serve, you know, in various aspects of what goes on around here? And, you know, being able to be involved. You know, just as Jethro told Moses, you know, find other people, delegate responsibilities, teach them what needs to be done. You know, sometimes things at a distance look pretty simple. Well, I know how to set up chairs. But then it's like, you know, the person that's been doing it for 20 years goes, yeah, but, you know, you got to keep this in mind. You got to remember this family has, you know, six kids, so you need a row for them. I mean, there's just simple things that after they do it for a while that can be passed on that, you know, you don't think about at first. We got to begin planning for our future. We have to begin engaging and mentoring our young adults and our teens and getting them engaged in a more formal way before it's forced on any of us. You know, somebody dies and nobody knows what to do. We have to find a way to do something more structured. Philippians chapter 2. I'm going to begin to try to wrap this up. Philippians chapter 2. I think most of you know me well. I am a totally willing person to get anybody of any age involved in the congregation, finding ways to serve. I remember when I was a kid, you know, back in the day, you know, it's like even something as simple as a 10-year-old kid handing out hymnals at church. What did it teach me? Was it super hard? No, but you know what it taught me? I remember one time saying to my mom, I got to be at church this week because I'm at the door this week handing out hymnals. Got to make sure we're there on time. You know, you're just learning responsibility. You're learning that you got a schedule and you got to keep mindful of that and know when it's your turn. So even something as simple as that, which, you know, some people say, I don't want to do that. But there's just simple, basic things that at a young age somebody can learn. One of our congregations in New England, there was always a few kids that it became their little thing after church, that who could pick up the most hymnals after church. They were always scurrying around. Yeah, better grab a hold of your stuff real quick because they'll yank the hymnal off from under it. But that's what they liked to do. It was their way of serving. Philippians chapter 2, verse 1 says, therefore, if there's any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also the interests of others. You know, when we were in New England, we had an individual that would come to church every week and would literally stand there and do nothing. I think I told the story about starting services an hour late. So they showed up. They always showed up 10 minutes late to church. And so this particular week, they were actually 50 minutes early by accident. When they realized they were 50 minutes early and we were setting up chairs, they left. And they came back 10 minutes late for church. They weren't about to set up a single chair. They just weren't going to do anything. They were not going to serve. Remember in the beginning of my sermon, I shared our vision, a church led by God's Holy Spirit, joined in it together by which every member supplies, all doing their share and growing in love. And then I asked you these three questions. What have you been supplying? What share of the load have you been carrying? And then if everyone served the church in the same manner, with the same amount of effort, same amount of time, same amount of energy as you are, or I am doing, what would that look like? How much would actually be getting done? You know, every week at Sabbath service, there's a whole host of things that just happen. Right? We've got a certain rhythm here, and it's nice that we have a hall. We can usually keep things set up. That helps a lot. But, you know, every congregation has any variety of, you know, who makes sure it's clean when we arrive, who's responsible to clean up when we leave. If it's the same person, that can be an extra long day. If they got to be here at noon and they're here till late. who makes sure the chairs are set up and rows are straight and clean, who corrects and moves them over because the last guy put them in the wrong spot. You know, who is that guy? I'm still trying to figure out who it is. You know, who makes sure we have seats for families with small children, who makes sure we have the mother's room set up and ready to go, who makes sure the bathrooms are clean, that things are stocked, who check, somebody has to check that. You know, a lot of us show up and don't realize it's already been done. We don't realize somebody's doing those things, but somebody makes it a point to just do all this stuff and make sure it's all ready to go. And maybe there's a way that you could do some of those things. Who makes sure the AC is functioning properly, especially today, because I am sweating horribly, Mr. Horton. I'm looking right at you, buddy. No, I'm a bit warm. My wife says I'm comfortable, which tells me I'm going to be warm. But what about parking, watching for visitors, helping them in, greeting them? Who makes sure our stage is set up, ready to go? You know, it's our sound people that pretty much handle this. We leave that to them. Don't touch nothing. I don't want to break it. But all these details, water on the stage, organizing special meals, there's so many little details that all have to be done. There are so many more things that could be done, organizing rides for people who need them. You know, I know some people who can't contribute in a lot of physical ways. I know some of you are always praying for people that are on the prayer list. That's a way you can serve. Or maybe you're sending cards to people. That's a way you can serve. Right? That's a way you're contributing, carrying the load. Well, in the weeks ahead, you know, thinking about moving things forward, I want to schedule a meeting of our deacons and elders and look at how we're currently organized. I want to start with them and ask them if they want to keep doing all that they're doing. You know, maybe they're burning out. You know, the nature of people that carry a heavy load and tend to burn out, usually they don't say anything. So I want to ask them, you know, is there too much on their plate? Is there more they feel they can be doing? Would they like to take on mentoring our young people and doing some of the planning and things that go on? So I'm going to start there. And then we'll circle back around and we'll see if there's more ways for members to be involved, to plan activities, to get more going here locally. I want to conclude in Hebrews 11, the faith chapter. Depending on your Bible, some will title it, you know, the triumphs of faith, heroes of faith, the hall of faith. But these are individuals that obeyed God when they didn't know the consequences for that obedience. They consider themselves dwelling in this life temporarily, waiting for God's kingdom. Notice Hebrews 11, verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. You know, if each and every one of us are willing to sacrifice a little of our time, maybe be a little inconvenience now and then, maybe it's going a little out of your way to give somebody a ride to church or whatever it may be, we all should be willing to do some of that to serve one another. You know, Mr. Armstrong years ago used to describe it as giving or taking. You know, do you show up every week to see what we can get from the congregation, or are we showing up with what can I give? You know, what can I give to my brothers and sisters as they come here? You know, sometimes it's words of encouragement. You know, maybe that's a gift. Maybe you're an encourager. I had a friend that jokingly says, he said to me one time, my family says I have the gift of criticism. I hope that's not anybody's gift here. But maybe you're an encourager. Maybe you're the exact opposite. And you, as you come to church, you're thinking, I hope to see so-and-so today. I want to encourage them. Right? Whatever it is you can do to give of your time and energy to the congregation, you know, again, this is how we all prepare a people. This is something we can actively do in preparing a people. And again, there's legitimate reasons we know why some can't. Health and other factors. So we understand that. So why are we here? Why are we here? We're here because God is calling us to his kingdom to serve. And part of why we're here, it's not just the knowledge we attain on the Sabbath, but it's putting it into practice and finding ways to serve. Whatever projects would come up, whether opportunities there may be, and rallying around, serving one another. You know, Jesus himself said in Luke 22, "For who is greater, the one who sits at the table or the one who serves?" And he ended it by saying, "I am among you as the one who serves."